Ave podcast listeners, just an FYI before the new episode of Emperors of Rome. Last year we asked for some questions for a Q&A episode, and occasionally I get a question, I get talking with an academic, and suddenly it becomes a lot bigger than a simple answer to a simple question. And so that's what you're about to hear today. This episode on Roman health and medicine originally came via a question from Mark Porton in Queensland, Australia. So Ave to you, Mark. Thanks for your question, and I hope you enjoy the episode. Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Leanne McNamara, a lecturer in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University. This is episode CXXXIV, Health and Medicine in Rome. The Romans had some strange ideas when it came to medical practice, but a lot has changed between now and then, so you have to give them some leeway. Some of the medical practices they used showed forward thinking, but you might have to ignore the cabbages. Here's Leanne McNamara.
There's really two strands to Roman medicine, at least in imperial times. There's traditional Roman medicine that's been practiced from time immemorial, which was in the hands of the family. The head of the family, the pater familias, was in charge of looking after the health of the entire household. So that would include family members.
Slaves?
And slaves, yeah, absolutely.
Ouch.
Slaves.
Jeez.
And the animals as well. It all falls under the same umbrella of taking care of the household.
Yeah.
So traditionally, that was how medicine was practiced. It was certainly not professional.
Yeah, must make childbirth awkward.
It probably did, yes.
And what were the influences of it? Where did that knowledge come from? I know that medicine in Rome had a lot of Greek influences.
So certainly Greek influence entered into Rome from the 2nd century, definitely, and probably much, much earlier than that. The Romans had interactions with the Greeks for a long time. But we hear about, in Pliny, we hear about the first doctor who comes to Rome from Greece. He's from Sparta, Archagathus. Mm. He doesn't get a very good reception in Rome, though. We have to keep in mind that Pliny does not like Greeks or Greek doctors in particular when he's telling us this story, though. So at least as far as the Romans are concerned, Greek medicine enters into Rome and it's a problem.
Tell me more about that doctor. Why didn't he get a good reception? Being from Sparta, is he like an amputation expert or a...
Absolutely.
Am I generalizing and stereotyping?
No, he's brought in as a wound specialist.
Yeah.
It's interesting that he is brought in by the authorities and set up with a shop at the crossroads of a busy intersection.
Mm.
So he's definitely got a position that's acknowledged by the authorities. But he came to be known, at least as far as Pliny tells us, as the carnifex or the butcher or executioner because of his very nasty techniques. He used cautery and surgery, cutting with the knife, quite different from the gentle sort of herbal remedies, I guess, and incantations and amulets that the traditional Roman paterfamilias might have employed.
Yeah, right. So that was the other aspect of it. I guess you had the surgical aspect, but then you also had a faith one as well.
Yeah, absolutely. There's many, many interactions between what we might think of as secular medicine and religious medicine in antiquity. It's very difficult to separate the two, really. So doctors that practice what we might think of as secular medicine now, Galen, for instance, the imperial physician, certainly believed in the gods, the healing deities, grew up in a town with a big shrine or temple to Asclepius. He invoked Asclepius himself when he wanted to get out of going on campaign with Marcus Aurelius to Germania. He says that he had a dream from Asclepius telling him not to go. So that was a rather convenient dream, perhaps, but there's no doubt that there's a lot of interaction between the different types of healers in Rome.
Mm. Okay, so if I was in the Roman Empire and I got sick, what sort of treatment should I expect? And I know that'd probably be different depending on my position in life and, you know, whether I'm the emperor or whether I'm, let's be honest, I'd be a pleb. But what sort of treatment could I expect? Should we maybe start with the emperors?
Okay, well, there was a whole range of treatments that everybody could choose from, whether it was the emperor or the lowest of the low pleb. The imperial family usually employed doctors, medici. So they might be someone like Galen, whom I've just mentioned. Mm. He was the physician to Marcus Aurelius and his son, Commodus, and then Septimius Severus after that.
Really? So, yes, he stuck around.
He did stick around for a long time
through
in
regime
Rome.
Regime change.
Yes, yeah.
Okay, and we know about a couple of other doctors, though, early ones, don't we?
Yes, absolutely. The first Emperor Augustus, we hear about his doctor, Antonius Musa, who apparently cured Augustus of a terrible illness by recommending cold baths and cold potions be drunk. Augustus was so very grateful that he got a statue erected of himself next to Asclepius, we're told. So that's another instance of crossover between religious and secular medicine.
Yeah.
And we're told that all doctors from that time on had immunity from tax, were exempt from paying tax.
Oh, nice.
That's very nice indeed. Although we hear about this sort of exemptions from tax from time to time. It seems that it didn't stick with Augustus at any rate. So that's another doctor that we know of. Claudius had an infamous doctor, Xenophon, who is accused, at least in Tacitus, of being part of the plot to kill Claudius. Claudius's wife, Agrippina, is said to have arranged poison to kill her unwanted husband to allow Nero to power.
He would have administered the poison?
Well, it's said that the poison was not working. So it's not Xenophon who administers the poison. Mm. It's a sorceress. But when it's not working quickly enough, Xenophon enters upon the scene in the guise of trying to help Claudius. But in fact, Tacitus tells us he's got a feather dipped in poison himself and under the guise of trying to get Claudius to vomit, in fact, administers the lethal dose and Claudius dies.
Oh, so he actually did the deed.
He did in the end. He finished him off.
Can't trust doctors.
There's a story that doctors had sworn an oath to kill their patients, which is one reason that the Romans were very suspicious.
It's a very bad business model.
It's not a great business model. I think they're really misunderstanding the Hippocratic Oath there, but nonetheless, that's the story.
Okay, so that's if I've got a lot of money, I get a doctor with a good reputation, I suppose.
Absolutely. You can employ a whole range of them. Claudius, for instance, travelled with another doctor, so Scribonius Largus, who tells us about that himself. We don't hear about that from the historians.
Yeah.
So he was a doctor who travelled with Claudius on campaign to Britain. So there's definitely more than one physician in the imperial household.
And if I'm of the lower ranks of society, if I'm a pleb, do I go down to the market? Is there a bulk billing place?
There's no bulk billing place, but absolutely you can find a healer who's going to charge different rates depending on who you are. So there's a whole range of healers who do operate in the marketplace.
Mm.
Some of them might have had, in fact, did have permanent shops, or we might think of them as clinics today, but others were travelling doctors as well, especially in the more provincial towns. And it was considered good practice for a doctor to travel around, get to know the different types of climates and the different constitutions of people in different places. Doctors could travel in and out of these provincial towns too.
Okay.
So a pleb might have to travel to a nearby town if he or she was in a very rural, remote area. We hear about that happening from time to time, needing to travel into town to get treatment when a vine cutter accidentally trims the end of his finger a bit too close. He needs to go to the local town to avail himself of some medical attention.
Is it also medical care along the lines of, look, I've got a sore back, I might go and get an amulet? Is that the sort
Absolutely.
Of medical care that I'm getting?
So there's a whole range of people. You can go to a drug seller who might supply you with something that we would recognise as pharmacologically active, herb or drug, but also might give you an amulet. You can go to a priest or visit one of the healing sanctuaries and ask for assistance from the god. Not necessarily in isolation. You could also go to a whole range of healers all at once and hedge your bets if you like.
Okay, okay. So what kind of reputation did doctors have then amongst Romans?
Well, there was a range of reputations, again, that doctors had. So we hear from Cicero, for example, that he very much admired and liked his doctor and trusted him. Mm. Seneca also is very appreciative that when he is ill, his doctor comes to see him, dropping all of his other duties and not seeing any other patients.
That's because he's Seneca.
That's right. But we hear other stories as well, and Marshall got lots and lots of fabulous stories about how terrible doctors are. I can read you a couple. The 47th epigram from book one. Until recently, Dialis was a doctor. Now he is an undertaker. He is still doing as an undertaker what he used to do as a doctor.
Is the doctor's name Dialysis?
No.
Okay, all right.
It means two flutes. Dialysis. Okay. Yes. Oh, so, but it is a Greek name, and that's interesting. I'm sure that's where some of the hostility that Marshall is exhibiting here is coming from.
Doesn't like Greeks. Okay.
Although it must be said that somewhere between 60 and 90% of all of the names that we have of doctors in Rome are Greek.
Wow.
So
okay.
It really is a profession. In the hands of Greeks.
Mm.
Another doctor that's got a Greek name is Dr. Symmachus. Marshall tells us his experience with Dr. Symmachus. He says, I felt a little ill and called Dr. Symmachus. Well, you came, Symmachus, but you brought 100 medical students with you. 100 ice-cold hands poked and jabbed me. I didn't have a fever, Symmachus, when I called you, but now I do. So poor Marshall is worse for wear after being visited by the doctor and the 100 medical students. Anyone who's been to a public hospital in Australia might feel some sympathy with Marshall there.
Look, every doctor was a medical student at some point, so it's got to be kind of done. But yeah.
That's all right.
What's the other one that you got there, 6.7?
You are now a gladiator, although until recently you were an ophthalmologist. You did the same thing as a doctor that you now do as a gladiator. You put out eyes, in other words.
Oh, okay.
Injure eyes. Yes. This is about a woman, Leda. Leda told her aged husband that she was suffering from a womby disease, and she regrets that intercourse is necessary for her. Yet, with tears and groans, she says her health is not worth the sacrifice and declares that she would rather die. Her husband bids her to live and not desert the bloom of her years, and he permits to be done what he cannot do himself. Immediately, the male doctors come in and the female doctors depart, and her feet are hoisted. Oh, what stringent treatment.
Whoa.
So, yes, that's a bit racy, isn't it? The doctors are definitely not following their Hippocratic oath there.
Okay. And Marshall knew about it.
And absolutely, Marshall knew about Leda at any rate.
Yeah. That's one of the more therapeutic practices, I guess you'd call it. What sort of herbal remedies were they using back in Rome? I imagine that, you know, you rely on the land quite a lot. There's a lot of good herbs and natural cures which might and might not work, depending on how you ground it or where you get it from.
Yeah, absolutely. And herbal remedies are the mainstay, I guess, of traditional Roman medicine in the hands of the gentleman farmer, if you like.
Yeah.
The paterfamilias would be well familiar with the properties of the plants. So herbal remedies ranged from what were called simples, like a single ingredient, sometimes a very commonly available foodstuff, for example.
Mm.
Cato has a whole chapter in his book. Interestingly, it's a book on how to manage a farm. And as part of Cato the Elder's instructions to the paterfamilias about how to run a farm, he's got a couple of chapters on medical treatments, how to look after the slaves and the animals.
Okay.
He has an entire chapter on cabbage. Cabbage is the miracle drug, as far as Cato is concerned. It can treat everything.
I wouldn't want to sit next to him in the Senate then.
Oh, no. Do you want me to read some of
them? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, let's see if I can find them. Where are the herbals? This is just part of the section. Dislocations will be healed quickly if they are bathed twice a day in warm water and a cabbage poultice is applied. If applied twice a day, the treatment will relieve the pain. A contusion will burst, and when bruised cabbage is applied, it will heal. An ulcer on the breast and a cancer can be healed by the application of macerated cabbage. And if the spot is too tender to endure the astringency, the cabbage should be mixed with barley flour so it can be applied. All sores of this kind will heal, a thing which no other medicine can do or cleanse.
Right.
So cabbage is good for everything from stomach upsets through to dislocations through to breast cancer.
Wow.
Yes.
I don't think that'd hold up these days.
No, although it's interesting that still in maternity hospitals today, cabbage leaves are often applied to the breasts of lactating mothers when they get soreness. So, yes, it's a bit of a folk tale or an old wives' remedy, but it's still being used today and recommended today.
The font of all knowledge, Pliny the Elder, what does he say about this sort of stuff in his encyclopedia?
He has a lot to tell us.
He's got books
books in his encyclopedia dedicated to this sort of thing. Of most of the 1,000 or so plants that he mentions, almost all of them have some kind of medicinal purpose that he tells us about.
Mm.
He's pretty keen on radishes, for example. He gives us 43 different uses of radishes to heal. So he, like Cato, is into the readily available foodstuffs. He tells us radishes are good too for curing ulcerations of the intestines and suppurations of the thoracic organs if eaten with honey. Some people say, however, that for this purpose they should be boiled in earth and water, a decoction which, according to them, promotes the menstrual discharge. Taken with vinegar or honey, radishes expel worms from the intestines, and a decoction of them boiled down to a third, taken in wine, is good for intestinal hernia. Employed in this way too, they have the effect of drawing off the superfluous blood. Medius recommends them be given to persons troubled with spitting of blood and to women who are suckling for the purposes of increasing the milk. Hippocrates recommends females whose hair falls out to rub the head with radishes, and he says that for pains of the uterus, they should be applied to the navel. So radishes are just as good as cabbage at treating everything from intestinal upset through to gynecological issues with menstruation.
Well, baldness.
Baldness, very important. So perhaps the rubbing on helped with the baldness, might increase the blood flow, but I'm not sure the radish is doing much.
If I'm ever not feeling well, I'm just going to go down and roll around in the veggie patch for a while, I think.
Have a bit of coleslaw and rub it liberally over you. Yes. That's one end of the herbal remedies.
Mm.
But of course, the other end could be compounds that involved many, many ingredients. Galen had a famous theriac that he compounded for the Emperor Marcus Aurelius that had 77 ingredients, some of which were very exotic from faraway places.
Mm.
Marcus Aurelius used to take this theriac every day, and so perhaps it's not surprising to learn that one of the ingredients was poppy juice or the latex of the poppy. So perhaps he in fact had an opium addiction.
Oh, okay.
So plant stuffs definitely were used, but also animal products were used and even minerals. So while amulets that are inscribed with perhaps incantations or magical words were looked down upon by the high and mighty secular Medici, definitely those doctors were still using minerals or stones and applying them.
That's just not even a Roman thing. That's still around these days. Wear an amber bracelet to get rid of your pain or a copper bracelet.
Bracelet, absolutely, or put magnets in your mattress. Yep. Yes, you can do that.
A very common need for doctors back in this time, in any time, is for assistance, for advice, for help with childbirth. So how did doctors deal with childbirth in the Roman times?
So just as with any healthcare concern, the patient had a lot of choice in antiquity. Midwives were definitely available, and they ranged. These midwives could be simply the local woman who's delivered a few babies through to somebody who has had some training. We've got a medical treatise written by a doctor, Serranus, he has a whole section on what makes a good midwife. And one of the things that he points out, apart from the fact that the midwife should be sober and moral and upright and she should have long fingers, one of the other things that he suggests is that she is able to read and write and that she has a sound theoretical understanding of medicine.
Fair enough.
Yes, which seems like good advice to me too.
Yes. I'm okay with that.
Yes. So midwives were definitely working in conjunction with other medical practitioners, people who might see themselves not as midwives but as doctors.
Yeah, yeah.
Serranus, of course, being a doctor, very much puts the midwife in a secondary position though. He's ready to step in when there's a problem that the midwife is not dealing with correctly.
Mm. So as well as long fingers, were they using medical instruments of any sort?
So birthing stools are well attested to, and there's a wonderful image of a birthing stool on a gravestone in Ostia Antica. It shows a midwife. Her name's Scribonia Attica. Note that name. Attica is a Greek name again.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's that Greek connection with the midwives. And Scribonia Attica has herself illustrated on the tomb delivering a woman sitting in a birthing chair. It's got handles on the side for the woman to grip onto.
Mm.
It leans backwards and there's an attendant behind the woman who's delivering there. And the base of the chair is cut out, of course, to allow the midwife to deliver the baby.
Wow.
Serranus describes a very similar chair in his text as well. So clearly they're well attested too.
Yeah, yeah, they put a lot of thought into that. How about caesareans? They would have come up occasionally.
Yes, well, in modernity, we very much associate caesarean sections with Julius Caesar and the Roman world, although those stories about Julius Caesar being delivered by a caesarean section are, I think, a folk tale. They come to us from Pliny, of course, the encyclopedist who tells us all sorts of things, logical and illogical. There is a law, the Lex Caesarea, that's attributed to the second mythical king of Rome, Numa. So it seems to be a very long-standing law. This law was that women who were dying in childbirth must be delivered by caesarean section. But the idea there is not to save the baby so much as to allow the woman to be buried appropriately in an unpolluted way. It would not be appropriate to bury the woman if she'd died with the baby in utero.
Right.
So that seems to be where the idea of caesarean sections comes from for the Romans. Of course, caedo in Latin, which is related to the word Caesar, means to cut. We don't have any real world accounts of it happening, as far as I'm aware. But there are lots of mythological accounts. So that god that's most associated with healing in antiquity, Asclepius, is himself said to be delivered by a caesarean section.
Mm.
His father is the god Apollo, but his mother is a mortal woman. And the story goes that when this woman, Coronis, has an affair, Apollo goes and tells his sister Artemis, and Artemis burns up the poor woman.
Mm.
Apollo, though, saves his son by delivering him by a caesarean section from the burning mother. So definitely we have examples of caesarean section in mythology, but not so much in real world terms. And it's highly unlikely that a woman would survive such a procedure.
Yeah, yeah. But the babies occasionally.
The babies may. The babies might.
Yeah.
At least we've got the mythological accounts and the accounts of Pliny. He tells us a range of suspiciously famous people who are delivered by caesarean section.
Really?
Scipio Africanus, for example, as well as Julius Caesar. So it seems to be a marker that there's something special about these men, that they're born in this very spectacular way.
Mm.
Although, of course, we know that Julius Caesar's mother, Attia, was alive while he was, so it seems a highly unlikely story.
So let's talk about the spiritual and God aspect of it a bit now. You've mentioned Asclepius already, who came over, I assume, from the Greek mythology. What other gods were involved and what was the spiritual side of medicine in Rome?
There were a whole range of gods that were thought to be particularly effective at healing, but it's not something that's confined to any one deity. So people could make sacrifices to or requests of any god. So Apollo Medicus in particular is perhaps the first of the Greek gods that we hear about coming to Rome. Mm. He is brought to Rome when Rome is suffering a plague and the Sibylline oracles are consulted. Apollo is then given a temple on the outskirts of Rome in 431 BCE. So this is very early.
Yeah.
Interestingly, it's outside the walls of Rome because foreign gods need to be outside the walls of Rome. But he's brought in response to a plague. In 292, many hundreds of years later, Rome suffers another plague and his son Asclepius is brought over again from Greece. A delegation is sent to Epidavros today, where there's a temple to Asclepius, and this delegation got Asclepius himself in the guise of a snake, brought him back to Rome on the boat in the guise of the snake.
Yeah.
And the snake slithered off the boat a couple of times, but finally lands on Tiber Island in the middle of the Tiber River, where the shrine to Asclepius is built, again, just on the outskirts of Rome, outside the walls, not in Rome itself. But that becomes a very important healing sanctuary for millennia, actually.
Oh, what a nice little story. Because the River Tiber is, I'm going to say famous, but it's not, of course. But it's famous for the Tiber snakes. You've got a very distinctive sort of snake there.
Yes.
So they've gone, oh, that's the snake that's come over with, yeah.
Perhaps they have, yeah. Yes. Yeah, Tiber Island, if you visit today, has still got that prow of the boat shape to remind you of that story that Asclepius himself chose that place to have his temple. It's still associated with healing today.
Yeah.
Shrines could be built to all sorts of healing deities, whether they were universal deities. Hercules is another god that's frequently prayed to or propitiated for health. The Egyptian Isis or Serapis, Sul Minerva in Roman England, Bath in particular has a healing sanctuary there as well.
Okay, so you get local deities kind of inhabiting those guises as well.
Yes, yeah. Yes. So Asclepius is perhaps the most famous, well-known, who has sanctuaries that are well-maintained by the Romans, renovated, if you like, by the Romans. The doctor that I mentioned might have killed Claudius. Xenophon was part of this renovation of the temple to Asclepius on the island of Kos.
Mm.
There's a large sanctuary in Pergamum as well. This is where Galen is from Pergamum. Epidaurus was renovated as well by the Romans. So they're very keen on Asclepius and making sure that his temples are well looked after. They become huge complexes with libraries and gardens, as well as areas for incubation. Incubation is where patients could sleep over in the temple and the god Asclepius could visit them in their dreams and cure them of their ills.
How about on the battlefield then, when you're away from temples, when you're away, I suppose, from good doctors, you would want a butcher.
Yes, you would want a wound specialist with you. Traditionally, perhaps in the earlier Republic, there might have been some soldiers patching each other up on the battlefield. The wounded soldier would then be sent home or at least to the nearest town. But by the imperial period, the army travelled with doctors. They were soldier doctors, if you like, specialists. These doctors could treat the soldiers on the battlefield itself, but also, particularly in the Western Empire, in Germania and so forth, where Roman camps ended up being set up, permanent camps, these camps had buildings that are dedicated to looking after the health of the soldiers. They're perhaps the earliest equivalent we have to hospitals.
Okay.
One valetudinarium, like a big barracks, really, with just row upon row of cubicles for beds.
Yeah.
But there's also dedicated rooms that look like they are essentially functioning as operating theatres, although, of course, there's no general anaesthetic equipment that we might recognise as a modern operating theatre. Nevertheless, we might recognise the surgical toolkit that army doctors, but also non-army doctors, civilian doctors, would carry: scalpels and probes and hooks and special spoon-like pieces of equipment that are used for scooping out arrows and other nasty projectiles that might need to be dealt with.
So it would have been quite brutal, though, you know, if you had anything seriously wrong with you. It seemed like it would just be like surface medicine. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. So human dissection was not practiced in Rome. So the internal anatomy was not well understood, it must be said. So very much just patching up. Although we hear accounts of amputations, of quite heroic skull surgery from time to time. So they were attempting to do what they could.
I've never heard skull surgery described as heroic.
Heroic. You've got to give it your best shot, like a hero.
I think you played your cards there.
I can tell you that although the hospitals were set up to deal with wounds, it seems that the hospitals or the valetudinaria were very much used for the soldiers who just got sick whilst in army camp. So I've got a fascinating collection of documents from Vindolanda near Hadrian's Wall in England.
Yeah.
We've got a duty roster for a particular day in 90 CE, and 31 of the 752 men in the fort there were off sick on this particular day in May. But only six of those were off because they were injured. The others are off with high proportion of eye injuries and being unwell generally.
Yeah, something's going around.
Yes, close quarters, you get infections.
Yeah. So what was the approach then about public health? I get the impression that Romans had quite good public health for the time.
Yeah.
If you want to look at it like that, and that a big part of that was down to how they treat water and cleanliness and public baths and aqueducts, etc.
I think that's an important aspect. So public health, as we might understand it, is not a concept that the Romans have, but the Romans are very keen on having an urban environment, a city that exhibits salubritas, healthiness or cleanliness. And so it's the Roman authorities' duty to site a city if a new city is being built in a place where the climate is good, where the air is good and the water is good. But in cities that are pre-existing, like Rome itself, it's also important to make the city salubrious, if I could use that term, by bringing in water. So aqueducts are very important. There were 11 aqueducts in Rome bringing water in. The source of the water was considered carefully. We've got a treatise by Vitruvius. He's often described as an architect, but he's more of a civil engineer, really.
Yeah.
And he goes into great detail about the building of the aqueducts and, in particular, looking at the location of the spring that the aqueduct is going to bring the water from to Rome.
Okay.
So you should examine the population who's living around the spring and make sure that they are a healthy people with well-formed limbs before you bring your water from there to Rome. So they're aware that water is important. And of course, the aqueducts are gravity-fed, so there's a continuous flow of water coming out of the fountains that they feed, which means the streets can be washed as well with this kind of off-flow. But some of the fountains we know were connected to the Cloaca Maxima,
to the
big
sewage system.
Giant sewer or drain.
Yeah.
And when the Tiber floods, there's backflow.
Yeah.
So the sewage, if you like, could flow back up into these water fountains, these basins.
Up until quite recently.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that still happens.
Does it still happen?
Well, I don't think it happens in the...
But you can see, you know, you can see photographs of it, you know, happening in early last century.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, just like flooded Rome for that reason. The sewage system all backs up.
So that's not so great when your water supply is tainted with the products from the sewer system. Bathing's really important part of Roman culture. it's associated with health for them.
Yeah.
And it's perhaps more healthy than in societies where there's no bathing. But I think perhaps the public health benefits of Roman baths has been overstated in the past. They're public baths. The water's not chlorinated. Mm. We're not sure how often the water was changed. And because baths are associated with health, when you are unwell, you go to the bath to have either a hot bath or a cold bath. It's a place where there are sick people congregating.
So Romans believed that baths were healthy and part of the health treatment and the regime of upkeeping your health.
I use
the word health too much, but it was essentially not that case at all because everybody believed that it was the case. Does that make sense?
Perhaps from a modern perspective, it's not great to have everybody with their parasites and their viruses and bacteria all in the one place. Yeah, perhaps not.
Okay.
The toilets are also perhaps a public health measure. There are public toilets in Rome.
But didn't they have a communal sponge?
Well, that's... Yes, we hear about this communal sponge in a couple of perhaps jokey texts, so it's not clear how common the communal sponge was, but if the communal sponge is indeed used in all the public toilets, yeah, that's not good for the spread of parasites. It's not good at all.
So on the face of it, I mean, I wouldn't want to live in ancient Rome. I would be endlessly washing my hands, and even then, they probably wouldn't be clean.
Yes.
But on the balance, it's more healthier because of public health measures than unhealthy, isn't it?
Well, perhaps. I think that the health of the population in Rome may well have been better than the population's health in, say, medieval or other pre-industrial cities for the time.
Mm.
Having said that, I'd prefer to live in Rome today with much more modern public health ideas. The Romans themselves didn't see the city as healthy, though. So the city is seen as a place that's not salubrious. If one is elite, one goes to the countryside to escape the pestilence that might be found in the city.
Ah, yes.
So the emperors, of course, have their villas in the south of Italy where they might escape from the city itself.
Or you've got somebody like Diocletian, who famously retired and went and grew his cabbages.
That's right.
And Cato would approve.
That would be a very good thing for his health, yes.
That's Dr. Leanne McNamara, a lecturer in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you may cast your pod. Please leave a review. They are always read and very appreciated. You can like Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter. We are at Rome Podcast. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, we'll be celebrating the Roman festival of Lupercalia. So until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.